So today what I wanted to do was actually look at, similar to what the ladies are going to be looking at this weekend, at the ladies weekend. So the theme for the ladies weekend was around Ecclesiastes 4:9-10. And it's, essentially what I will be talking about today. So we'll just read, Ecclesiastes. We'll actually read 4:7-12 to begin with. So if you want to turn there, it's Ecclesiastes 4:7. It says, and we know that this is Solomon who wrote this, likely Solomon who wrote this, and this was, you know, probably near the end of his life when he wrote this. And so Ecclesiastes is a pretty interesting book. So it's one of those you can almost get lost in because there's so much going on and so many things you could speak about. But, you know, I think this is a section that we're probably all familiar with, even those that aren't necessarily religious or, you know, pay attention to the Bible. It's something that, is a common phrase, you can say. So this is Ecclesiastes 4:7. It says, "Then I returned," and this being the preacher who's thought to be Solomon, it says, "Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun." And then in verse 8 it says, "There is one alone without companion. He is neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asked, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and grave misfortune." And we know that, probably the main premise of Ecclesiastes is this notion that everything that that this preacher did was vanity, was something that was fleeting, was something that was going away. And so here he talks about this toil where you toil alone, no matter how hard somebody works or no matter how much they accumulate, if they're doing it by themselves, there's really no purpose to it, no point. Then he goes on in verse 9 and it says, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor," right? So he's pointing out that, you know, once you start adding somebody else, now all of a sudden there becomes purpose, there becomes a point to the labor that you're doing. And then he goes on in verses 10, 11, and 12 to give some practical examples of why this is the case. Right, so in verse 10 it says, "For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him." Right, and I similar to what Mr. Carlson was talking about, right, being around in an area that there's lots of hiking and a lot of mountains and those kinds of things that you can go around, you know, you hear about a story or two a year where somebody goes hiking on their own, right? And they'll fall, down, portion of a mountain, or they might twist their ankle or something like that. And they're stuck there, potentially for a significant amount of time. And, it takes a lot of effort for rescuers to find them because there was no one there with them, right? So it's very practical advice here. And then in verse 11, it says, "Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone?" Right? And this is, again, something we would think is very practical advice. And probably in that day and age where you didn't have, especially if you were traveling, you didn't have, space heaters, you didn't have cars to keep you warm, one of the big ways that they would stay warm is by body heat, right? And of course, two people who are producing body heat are better than one, right? And keeps them both warmer. And then in verse 12, it says, "The one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him," right? So we know, notwithstanding Hollywood movies today where one person can take out 20, 30 different people, as long as they're the star of the movie, notwithstanding that, in all practical nature, right, we know that, if you have two people with you, one person's not likely going to come up and, cause trouble or pick a fight. Right? And then it goes on, "And a threefold cord is not quickly broken." And again, if you know anything about ropes, right, one cord can normally be broken. Two cords can come unwound, and it's even today, three cords are typically what make up a rope, right? And so three cords are put together to make a rope that is, ends up being quite strong. right? And so we see this, you know, as, like I say, kind of very practical advice, and as something that we would think is almost very basic, right? Because from the earliest times, you know, as children, we see this desire that people have to be with another person, right? They want to be held, or they want to be played with. They want someone to interact with them. And even as a child grows, they want somebody to be there around with them. And as I was putting this message together, I got home from work yesterday, and, you know, as kids are wont to do, Owen had made a mess in his room. And kind of, I guess, just a minute or two before I had gotten home, Tina had told him that he had to go clean up the mess. And he's in there crying as I get home, and he's saying, I can't do it. I can't clean it up all by myself, right? And probably if I wouldn't have been thinking about this, I would have said, yes, you can. Go clean it up by yourself. But, you know, I was thinking I had this on my mind. So instead, all I did was I walked in the room with him. I just stood there. I didn't do anything. I said, okay, now Owen, clean up. And just by the mere fact that I was in the room with him, he stopped crying. He cleaned up all the toys by himself. It was, you know, a difficult task. But, you know, in this case, he was just expressing the wrong feeling, right? He was saying that he couldn't clean up by himself. But what he really meant was he didn't want to be in the room by himself, right? He didn't want to be by himself. He wanted somebody else to be there. And we see this, you know, often in young kids, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, where, you know, there's things that they could do by themselves, but they just don't want to be by themselves, right? They want, at least my kids, you know, they want us to lay with them until they go to sleep. They want us to just be in the room with them. They don't want to, you know, be by themselves, but even just one other person gives them this comfort that they don't have by themselves. Right, and even in nature, we see this very same idea, right? Most animals, what do? They live in herds, or they live in packs, right? And then what do predators do, right? We see this often on the Animal Channel. I watch it every now and then, and you see, you know, in kind of the Animal Channel kind of way, where they're showing, you know, maybe wolves or lions hunting, and what do? They try to scatter a pack or scatter a herd so that they can get one animal off by themselves, right? They're looking for the slowest or the smallest of the animals that they can separate from the herd. Because even though, you know, we think these animals like lions or wolves are mighty predators, but even they don't want to go in and take on 2 or 3 animals, right? Unless they just have to. They want to be able to separate off. They want to be able to get just that lone animal that then they can gang up on, right? So we know even animals understand this value of large groups. And, you know, you might think, though, you know, something that has the United States, we have this reputation of being rugged individualist, right? So maybe, you know, from our country's perspective, we don't think it's, you know, historically, we've not thought it's been important to, you know, be together, be in pairs, to work together. But really, this is just a misunderstanding of what rugged individualism really was meant, right? So it was a term that started in the early 1900s. And the thought behind it was not that people were by themselves. It was that people, independent of the government, could take care of themselves, right? And the way that this was possible was actually the fact that you knew your neighbor, right? You knew what they needed. You were willing to help them with what they needed. You had that level of understanding from an individual perspective, one-on-one, that you knew what they needed and you could go help them, right? That the government didn't need to become involved because people as a community and as small groups were willing to come together and do that which was needed to happen for the welfare of everyone. Right? We, in Seattle, and it's been a few years, but I think the first maybe 10 or so years that I was out here, we had this group that we called the Barn Raisers, right? And this notion came from actually the Amish, right? And so what the Amish would do is any time that somebody needed to have a barn built, the whole community would come together, right, to build it for this person, right? It wasn't that they expected the person to go build it by themselves, right? The entire community would come together, and because of it, they would, you know, build these barns that were of high quality, would stand the test of time, but they would build them very rapidly, right? And each person knew that, you know, they would go help because likely they had been helped in the past or that they would be helped in the future doing something like this. And, you know, we can see many other examples, right? You know, you don't have just Lewis, who was the one that went across the United States and, you know, saw the Pacific Ocean. You had Lewis and Clark, right? We see a lot of these, this notion of pairs, people doing things together, people doing great things together, doing more than what they could do individually. And so this concept, and I'll kind of refer to it as, two being better than one relationships, right? We see this notion of two being better than one relationships quite often in the Bible, right? You can think of Jonathan and David, right? You can think of other examples, Elijah and Elisha, right? Where two would work together and, you know, have friendship build together. And so what I want to look at is, I want to look at some, you know, broad examples of the Bible, and I've looked at four of them, and so we'll look at four of them today, and they're both physical and spiritual examples of this principle, right? That a relationship that has two, or a two is better than one relationship. So the first one, right, is likely the one that Solomon was talking about here in Ecclesiastes, is friendship, right? And this is actually a topic that Solomon talks quite a bit about. And I think it's interesting, you know, when you read Solomon and you kind of compare and contrast him to his father David, we saw with David, at least as the Bible talks about it, David, it talks a lot about the people that David had a relationship with, right? He had the mighty men. He was close with the high priest. You know, he and Jonathan, right? And so a lot of David's life was talked about in this manner of relationships that he had. I mean, it showed that he had a lot of people, a lot of support system around him. But Solomon, as I read kind of his story, or reread his story this week, it's not nearly as much, right? I mean, yes, he had these, you know, 700 wives and 300 concubines, but it only talks about one son and two daughters. It doesn't really talk about also any of, you know, Solomon's mighty men. It doesn't talk about him having deep relationships with other people like the high priest or other advisors in his community. As I read it, and maybe I was reading too much into it, it almost felt like, you know, he was this single person that while he had great ability and great potential, you know, one of the reasons why he lost his way because he didn't have this support system, particularly after, you know, after King David died, to point him in the right direction, right? And so instead of going, you know, continually following God, he lost track later in life because he was, you know, led astray by these foreign wives that he had collected. But even in that, you know, he talks a lot about the value of friendship. And we see this particularly in the Proverbs. So I'll go through just a few of these where, you know, even over and above what he talks about in Ecclesiastes, he gives some very practical reasons why friendship is so important, right? So the first one is Proverbs 12:26. It says, "The godly give good advice to their friends, the wicked lead them astray," right? And so this shows that if you have friends, like one of the things that they'll provide you is advice. Now he goes on further and says, if you have godly friends, you'll get good advice. And if you have wicked friends, they'll give you wicked advice. But this is one of the practical things, right? You don't have to think about everything yourself. You don't have to, you know, you have that person where you can go and you can get advice about things that you question, things that you want to understand, right? Or in Proverbs 17:17, it says, "A friend is always loyal, and a brother is born to help in the time of need." So very much like Ecclesiastes, right? When you have these friends, when you have a brother that you can rely on, they're there and they're the most valuable when you have a need, right? And when you build up these relationships, it's better, you know, than if you didn't have a brother, if you didn't have a friend that was there to help you in need. Or in Proverbs 27:5, it says, "Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." So again, this shows where, you know, one of the values that a friend can provide is they can rebuke you when you're doing the wrong thing. They can put you back on the path that you should be following, right? That even if you, you know, think that they've wounded you because it might hurt your pride, or you might, you know, not want to be rebuked or shown that what you're doing is wrong, that it's actually a value of having friends, because they are willing to go put you back on this path of righteousness where enemies will let you just go astray and might even help direct you there. Right? Or you have, you know, Proverbs 11:14 again, which is similar, where there is no guidance, a people fails, but in an abundance of counselors, there are safeties, right? So again, this notion of very practically, one of the things friends can do for you is give you advice, give you guidance, you know, help you think about things that you might not think about yourself. And then the last one in Proverbs that I'll talk about, and there are several others that you could turn to as well, is Proverbs 27:17. It says, iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another, right? And so, again, this notion of when you have two men together, working together for a common purpose, they actually make each other better, right? You know, a common phrase today in business is, you want to find situations where 1 + 1 = 3, right? You don't just want two people to come together or two things to come together and just get, you know, that out of it. You actually want to be able to find ways that you can get more than what you had originally out of that relationship. So it's a very common thought, right? And Solomon also gives us warnings about what can happen if a man doesn't seek friendship or doesn't seek companionship. So in Proverbs 18:1, it says, a man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all wise judgment. So essentially the opposite notion of if you don't seek out advice, if you don't seek out friendship, what you'll end up being is kind of inward focused. You won't have anyone to correct your ways. And we can, you know, think about it even in examples that we've had in the United States, right? So the one that came to mind was, you know, someone like the Unabomber, right? I know a little bit about his background, but right, he was a very smart man, you know, genius, went to school, graduated early, and then he started isolating himself, right? And then he went down this path of, you know, starting to become paranoid about everything that was happening. And so we can see this, you know, very practically, that, you know, it's never good when a person starts to isolate themselves from their friends, right? Or in Proverbs 15:22, it says, without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. So again, this notion, and like I said, I mean, these were all, you know, from Solomon, where Solomon talks quite a bit about the value of friends and what they can do, both practically and kind of, or practically what they can do for you. And then this value of friendship, you know, is expanded in the New Testament, right? And so we see in John 15:12, it says, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. Right? And we know, we've talked about where laying down your life can be in many different ways. We know, you know, Christ laid down his physical life. You know, he was killed for us. But, you know, even today, without dying for somebody, there's ways that you lay down your life, right? If you're willing to give of your time, your effort, your money, you know, for someone else's well-being, these are examples of laying down portions of your lives for other people, right? And if you cultivate these friendships, if you have, you know, friendships with many people, you know, they're willing to do these things for you. And we as Christians are called to do these things for other people, right? And then in Galatians 6:1-2, it says, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. And then in verse 2, it says, bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. So again, this speaks, you know, essentially to the spiritual usefulness of what Solomon was talking about in Ecclesiastes 10, right? Where if two, or if one is walking by themselves, you know, who's going to bring somebody back? If you've isolated yourself from the rest of the congregation, you know, who is going to be there to bring you back if you go astray? But Christ, you know, calls on us to go help those that we see have gone astray, right? So kind of this flip side of one of the things that we are supposed to do as friends are to go, you know, ensure our brothers are following the path of righteousness and then help them back, you know, with the spirit of gentleness, when they do go astray. You know, we're to bear one another's burdens. And so we see, like I said, this notion of friendship kind of throughout the Bible, and there's a lot more that we can cover, and none of these am I going to go in depth on, but we see this value of friendship, both, you know, from the physical perspective and then also from a spiritual perspective of how it can help us, especially in our time of need. So then the second relationship that I want to talk about, the second kind of two is better than one relationship, is between a husband and a wife, right? So this is, you know, in fact, the one that God started man with, right? We know this example in Genesis, right? So we can go in Genesis 2:18, and it says, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." Right? So this is the exact sentiment that, you know, Solomon was starting in Ecclesiastes 8 when he talks about it not being good that one is alone. Right? God is telling us here that from the very beginning of the creation of man, that he didn't intend for man to be alone. He intended that man always be joined to a helper, right? And this first relationship, helper relationship that he gave mankind was, of course, between a husband and a wife, right? We can read on here in Genesis, skipping down, just to verse 21, it says, verse 20, you know, so God says that it wasn't good that man be alone, but then he let Adam figure out that he was alone and that it wasn't good for him. And so we read in verse 20, it says, "So Adam gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him." Right? So we see this notion that, you know, God knew that it wasn't good for man to be alone. But he wanted Adam to actually come to that understanding. He wanted Adam to understand that, you know, while he was surrounded by all these beasts, by all these cattle and birds, that he actually needed a helper that was comparable to him. All right. And so then it goes on and it says, "And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to man." And then in verse 23 it says, "And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Right? So we see here that, you know, this command that man is, you know, to be joined to his wife, they're to become one, but, you know, one in the same way that, you know, for example, a rope, you have two strands of rope and you bring them together and they become one rope, right? And so in the same way that, you know, while they're to become one, there's still two, and there's strength in this fact that there's two, right? But this relationship, you know, of course, is different than friendship, right? It's this holy union that is ordained by God, right? And I, again, won't go into great detail here because we could spend many hours just diving into marriage and the value of marriage and why God brought man and woman together in marriage to begin with. But what we do know is that God also warns us, right, what will happen if we don't take this relationship seriously, right? So we know in Malachi 2 verse 14, it says, "Yet you say," and this was God saying he was gonna, you know, essentially depart from Israel and let them be destroyed. It says, "Yet you say, for what reason?" And it says, "Because the Lord has witnessed between you and the wife of your youth with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant," right? So we see here that, you know, God is telling Israel that it is, you know, that this relationship that he gave him was very important, was a holy union, and he didn't intend it to ever be broken, right? And we could go on, but I think we, you know, would all agree and could easily prove through many examples of why marriage is such a good example of, you know, two is better than one, the strength that you get in marriage. But then when you think about now marriage, you kind of go on, or you can go on as Solomon did, right, in verses 12, in Ecclesiastes 12, where he talks about this three-quartered rope not being easily broken. So this notion that, you know, while one is better than two, three actually becomes even stronger, right? And we see this, you know, in the marriage relationship through children, right? And we know God tells us in many places what a blessing children are and the value that they bring to us, right? And we can look in Psalms 128. It says, "Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. When you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy and it shall be well with you. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house. Your children like olive plants all around your table," right? And we know olive plants are often symbolized as blessings, right? The value that you get. They're very valuable, or they were very valuable in that day, right? You got olive oil, which was, you know, something that was typically only afforded to the rich. And so if you had olive plants, this was your way of getting olives and olive oil. And so here God is comparing children to these olive plants. So he's, you know, essentially here saying, you know, when you eat the labor of your hands, so this is the one person eating the labor of your hands, you'll be happy. But then when you add your wife and your children, you actually get even more blessings than what you would have before, right? Or another example is in Psalms 127, verses 3 through 5. It says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with the enemies in the gate." So again, you know, if you think about this notion of, you know, one or two is better than one, but three is even better than two, you know, you can see how within this marriage relationship, God often equates children like this, right? And in the example, again, in Ecclesiastes verse 12, where he talks about, you know, the three-corded rope not being easily broken, you can see how it kind of aligns to this notion that, you know, when a person has many children, especially, you know, as they grow, you know, that person has some strength associated with it. You know, where here it says at the end that when he has this quiver full of them, they shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate, right? So this person who has, you know, a wife presumably and has many children, he has confidence that he's able to go and talk, you know, in this case to the enemies at the gate, because he knows that, you know, there's this strength that he has in his family. Right? And so again, we get this notion, or we get this understanding that, you know, this marriage relationship, especially as it produces children, you know, starts to show the same example that Solomon did in Ecclesiastes, where two is better than one, and then three becomes almost unbreakable or not easily broken. Right? And so these are kind of the physical relationships that God has given us to help us better understand this notion that two is better than one. But like so many of the things that God gives us in this physical life or this physical world, right, they're really just shadows of things to come. They're to help us understand, you know, from the physical perspective, which is all that we can, you know, kind of feel and touch and see and smell. It's to help us understand what is to be in the spiritual world. It's to help us understand what God is really planning for us, right? It's, again, a shadow of things that are to come. So it's not perfectly showing us what is to come, but it gives us an understanding. It helps us better understand that, you know, in the physical world, yes, two are better than one, right? As we said, they can lift you up when you've fallen, both physically and spiritually, right? You can, you know, get warmth, you can get comfort, you can get advice in the physical world from friends, from wives. But it's all leading us to a more spiritual view, right? Helping us understand that even in the spiritual world, that this notion that two is better than one still holds true, right? And in some ways, it's the very key to the plan of God, right? As we'll see over the next couple of examples. So So this next example that I want to talk about is about Christ and his disciples, right? And in some ways, you can think about this in much the same way as the friendship one. In fact, Christ himself uses this example, right? In John 15:14, he's talking to the apostles and he says, "You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain. That whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you." Right? And so, you know, one of the examples that Christ says that in our relationship with him is that we have this friendship relationship with Christ. I mean, think about that. Christ is telling us that he, you know, the one who's going to be the king over the entire world, the one who God the Father has delivered all responsibility, all power and authority into, right? He is willing to be that friend for us, right? He's willing to be that one that picks us up when we fall. He's the one willing to give us, you know, comfort, to willing to give us advice, willing to help us overcome the things that we could overcome, willing to be there when we need help, right? And so this is, you know, the first spiritual kind of example of this two is better than one, is that we have to think of in our relationship with Christ that he's our friend. That's how he wants us to think about him, or one of the ways that he wants us to think about him, right? And we know, you know, he's very explicit in the example of the yoke about why it is important, right? And so in Matthew 11:28, this is Christ talking. He says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Right? And so this notion that, you know, Christ is willing to be there and labor beside us, and if we labor in the way that Christ labors, you know, the yoke is easy and the burden is light. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, everything goes perfectly well. We know we'll have trials. We'll know we'll have, you know, burdens that we have to bear. But what Christ is saying here is that, you know, if you're willing to work with him, you know, as you might say, as a friend, if you're willing to rely on him as a friend, whatever burden you have, whatever yoke, whatever labor you're doing, it becomes easier when Christ is there with you, right? And so no matter how hard it is, it will become easier. Doesn't mean it will, you know, go away or that the trial just departs instantly, but he's there to walk beside you. He's there to lift you up when you've fallen. But again, it's actually not just one-sided, right? We know that, you know, while Christ is the all-powerful one, he actually wants us to be there helping him as well, right? And that it's not just about us putting our burdens, us putting our labors on Christ, but Christ actually wants us to help him in the labor that God the Father gave him, right? So just read one example, because we all know this pretty well probably, but in Matthew 28:18, right? This is the last time that he's speaking to the apostles. And we know, through the gospels that, you know, Christ said many times that the labor, the work that God the Father gave Christ to do was to preach the gospel into all the world. And we know that before Christ died, that it wasn't actually completed, right? He preached the gospel within basically the area of Judea, right? But as part of his ministry, right, he taught these apostles. He brought them up. He helped them understand, you know, the things of God, the ways of God. He helped them understand what his mission was on earth. And then we see at the very end, the last thing that he's talking to them about here in Matthew 28:18, he says, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you," similar to what Mr. Carlson had said in the sermonette, right? "And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Right? So we see here that this is not, you know, just a one-sided friendship that we should have with Christ. Christ is actually expecting us to go help fulfill the mission that God the Father gave Christ, right? So just like, you know, as a physical friendship, it can't always be one-sided. You know, even the spiritual relationship or the spiritual friendship we are to have with Christ is not one-sided, right? We're expected to not just have Him help us, right? Or we can't just expect that He will only help us. We have to be here with Him doing His work that God the Father gave Him, right? We have to be here preaching the Word, talking about God's way, helping people learn and understand, baptizing them into the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. We have to be part of this work. We have to help Christ with His labor that God the Father gave Him, right? Now, could He do it without us? Absolutely, right? He doesn't need us, but He wants us to be in this friendship relationship with Him, right? It's important for Him that we be there, right? He's going out of His way almost to have us part of this labor that God the Father had given Him, right? And so this is the first of the kind of spiritual, two is better than one relationships, is that this friendship that we have with Christ, which, as I say, is, you know, bi-directional. Yes, He's going to give us much more than what we could ever give Him, but that doesn't mean we don't give back to Him that what we are able to give back to Him, right? That we only expect to get from this friendship relationship from Him, but that we're actually willing to give Him what little we can. And then the last one that I want to look at today is the relationship between the Father and Christ, right? And, you know, it might be, you know, a little, it might not be, you know, necessarily the first one that we think about, because, you know, when we think about God, what do we know about God? We know that He's almighty, He's all powerful, He's all knowing. You know, and if any being could be there by himself and not, you know, need someone else's help, or not want someone else's help, maybe is a better way to say it, it would be God the Father, right? He's over all things. But we know that this relationship that God and Christ had from the very beginning was actually a symbiotic relationship, right? It was the two of them together forever, and then, or for all eternity in the past, and then at some point, you know, they wanted more. They wanted more than just two. And so you could see, you know, or, you know, maybe from the human perspective, you could see where just one of them could exist and they would be perfectly happy. They have everything they need, right? They don't need any help, right? And then if you have two of these beings, now you have some companionship. So you don't really need anything else, right? Like, what can we as mankind give them? What can the angels give them, right? They created all of this. But we know that, you know, Christ spent much of His ministry talking first about this pair relationship, right, between He and God the Father, right? And so in John 5:17, Christ is answering them, and He says, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working," right? So this notion, you know, back to Ecclesiastes, where Solomon is talking about only having one person labor, no matter how much they accumulate, how much they bring together, it's not fulfilling, right? And we see that, you know, God the Father and Jesus Christ, they never had this, you know, problem, might you say. They were always two working together for one purpose, right? They were always together, making sure that each one of them was providing that which they could provide and doing more together. Right, and so we see this notion of the Father and Christ laboring together actually from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end, right? We know in Genesis where it says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness." So for the very beginning of the Bible, we know that God is working together with Christ, or the Father and Christ are working together, right? They make man at the beginning. And then at the very end, right, as at least what we understand, or at least as far as we know into the future, right, Revelation ends with what? The new Jerusalem coming down to earth, right? This new city that they built together, right? The Father coming down and dwelling with man, right? Their plan, or at least the plan that we know about, or as far in the future as we know about, this plan finally comes together, right? And so from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end, we see it's really a book about these two beings, these two all-powerful, almighty beings, working together, laboring for some purpose, right? Laboring together. But it's not just about laboring, right? So we can see, especially in this example, when, you know, Christ is a physical being at the very end of his life, what do we know that he does, right? So you can, this is in John 17:1, you know, it's after the last Passover, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to, and what does he do? He prays because he knows that the Jews are about to come and take him, and he knows the trial that he's about to go through, right? He knows that he's going to, go through the crucifixion. He'd go through the scourging. And so what does he, you know, do in this case, right? You can imagine this is the case where figuratively, right, he's about to fall down, or maybe he is even falling down because he knows what, you know, this trial is going to be for him. And we know in Luke 22:39, what he does. It says, coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Right? So we see in the face of this trial that he knows is about to come, what does he do? He goes and he strengthens himself with this relationship that he had with the Father. Right, and then in verse 43 it says, then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. Right, and so, you know, God the Father, you know, is exactly as what Ecclesiastes or Solomon said in Ecclesiastes. Right, God the Father sent this angel down to Christ to strengthen him. Right, so in this time of his greatest need, there was the Father doing what was needed to strengthening him, preparing him for this great trial that he was about to have. And then it goes on, you know, and it shows how much agony he had. In verse 44, it says, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. When he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. So we see, right, that it is this, that in this trial, right, where he's in so much agony that he's actually sweating blood, right, that he goes to the Father for this strength, and the Father, you know, as you would expect, is there to strengthen him. He's there to, you know, build him up, prepare him for this trial that he's about to come. But then, you know, just a short period of time later, right, at the very end of the crucifixion, we can see this even more. You know, how important this relationship between God the Father and Jesus Christ was in Matthew 27:46, where for that short period of time, right, it says that God forsake him. So we read in Matthew 27:46, and it says, about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lama, and then I won't even say the last one. It says, and that is it. And it's translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? And so we see this great anguish for this short period of time where, you know, God essentially, because of the sins of all mankind being rested on Christ and God not being, not wanting to be part of sin or have no part of sin, that he had to separate himself from Christ just for a short period of time. But in this short period of time, you know, you see this great anguish that Christ is going through. So you see, you know, even these two all-powerful beings, right? Do they need each other? I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but I think it's clear that they want to be in this relationship together. That they have a strong desire, and that it actually hurts them, right? It gives them great anguish when they have to separate for even this small period of time. right? And we know that, you know, as I said, that this labor that the Father and Christ talk about through the entire Bible, right? This is actually then going on to the last piece of what Solomon talks about, right? So as I said, you know, you have these two all-powerful beings. They could have been, you know, perfectly happy themselves for all eternity. They didn't necessarily need anybody else, but at some point they desired more. They desired not just for two of them, right? But they desired for a whole creation, right? So we know they created the angels. They created mankind, and they created mankind with a purpose, right? And that purpose is, you know, in the two is better than one, it's the three is even better than two notion, right? They created mankind so that we would be part of their family for all eternity, right? They are laboring, or they have been laboring, and they are still laboring, and they're looking for that reward, and that reward is actually a broader relationship, more people part of their family. They want, you know, not just one, two, you know, Christ or God the Father and then Christ. And then you can think of the third, right, which is the first fruits. So the church, right, who is going to be part of that relationship. And then going on, you know, we don't know how it expands from there, but we know that God, you know, is always looking to expand. And so this notion that, you know, two are better than one, three is even better, and that's part of what the labor that God and Christ, or a big part of the labor that God and Christ have been doing through the entire Bible. And so we see, you know, that, as I said, that, you know, while Solomon was talking about this Ecclesiastes 9 and 10 being two people are better than one, that it actually is just a shadow of things that are happening in the spiritual realm. Right? And something that happened from the very beginning, right? So you had God and Christ together forever, right? So we see this principle that Solomon laid out was not really, you know, Solomon's principle. This is a principle, you know, you could say for all eternity going back, which was, you know, always the idea was that two was better than one, right? You always had God and Christ together. And then as soon as they created mankind, they created a man and a woman and put those together as one. And then they go on and they talk about, you know, and explain such the importance of friendship, right? So it's, you know, many-dimensional relationship, but it's always this notion of when you look at relationships, having many people and having many relationships is better, you know, and even, like I say, in the case of God and Christ, where they might not need more people, you know, like we do as physical beings, they actually desire it. This is what they want, right? And so here we've seen, you know, four examples of this, you know, two is better than one relationship, and even, you know, examples of where you start adding in, you know, a third, a fourth, a fifth as you go on, right? And so, you know, in some ways, you can think about this, these set of scriptures as being, you know, part of the fundamental premise of the Bible, right? Fundamental premise of God's plan, right? It's something that, you know, if we, you know, one way that we talk about the Bible is that it's a story of relationships, right? And so it makes sense, right? If God and Christ have always had a relationship, if they're looking for a relationship with each one of us, right? It makes sense that, that they would continue and they would put much emphasis on the fact that, you know, we need to be building relationships together, right? And for us today, you know, the practical side of it is as Solomon laid out, right? We're human beings. We fail. We get tired. We don't have, you know, an all-knowing capability. We need advice, right? And so, you know, God has given us, you know, almost this need for these relationships. But if it just ends there, it's, you know, still a shadow of the things that are to come. And we have to understand that these relationships that we're building are there to help teach us what God and Christ desire for all eternity, right? And so this is, you know, it's, like I said, Ecclesiastes has a lot of interesting pieces, and I think this is one of them where, you know, Solomon you know, as the wisest man in the world, you know, was able to understand and kind of bring out this very nugget of what the Bible is all about, right? That it's all about building relationships, that it's about, you know, seeing not just by yourself what your own desires are, but seeing where you can come together with another person and go do more together, right? And so, this was, like I said, it was an interesting study as I read about it and started looking at it, and, you know, even identified kind of examples in my own life where this comes together and where we can think differently, right? That it is important that we come together, build these relationships, that it can't be just a, you know, one-time thing, but it has to be something that we build and grow over time, because it's going to be something that lasts for all eternity. And so, you know, just no, I guess, practical advice, but more just to think about, you know, as we interact with people, you know, how are we building those relationships? How do we, you know, in our life see these examples where, you know, two is better than one, you know, just like when we want to think and praise God for when He helps us out, do we think and praise other people when they're there for us, right? When they pick us up, do we go back to them and thank them? Do we build these relationships? Do we focus on these relationships? And so, you know, just as we go through our day, we go through our week, think about these relationships. Think about the value of them that they have for us, and think about what they picture for all eternity, that, you know, we will be there together with God and Christ in a relationship that they've had forever, and that they're inviting us into that relationship for all eternity.